Are we ready back there?
Yeah, I was trying to.
Okay. And this, as we know, we're here for a workshop, and just for the basics of what a workshop is we're going to sit and we're going to talk, go over a training of what what the statutes provide, what rules and what instructions that govern the activities or actions that y'all must take. And you'll be free, members of the board, to, you know, we'll do this as informal as we do our code board. Free to ask any questions, stop us along the way. I know there's a number of, I have a slide presentation, there's a number of slide presentations. But it's not really structured, it's just informative as we go, as we talk. And I'll go through the various areas, and like I said, we'll put emphasis on things of great importance. Charlie's here as a council, and also to give you points of importance for the things that you do as well. And together, between the two of us, as well as with Hector, we'll do everything we can to leave you feeling adequately trained and ready to march into the future.
Mentioning training, did you by any chance invite the commissioners to attend?
General invitation was sent out, I believe, in the manner of the standard invitation, so it would have included the commissioners. As I mentioned, ground rules for the public understanding for the workshop, the way that works is that this is a function of staff and instructors to the board. It's public in the sense that the public is welcome to observe and understand what's going on. It's really generally not something where it's open to public discussion or inquiries or anything else. So we don't anticipate that, but we'll always leave those things to Mr. Singer.
Of course, the public is certainly welcome to, you know, it's a board workshop, so we're not going to preclude the public from getting involved if they have a question or they have anything they want to add. Certainly can do so. What I'd like to do, first of all, is to say thank you, because it's very, very difficult to get people to serve on this particular board. Code enforcement boards are very tough, because your board is different than the planning board, the board of adjustment, the appropriation board, the community development board. Your board is a little bit different because you have quasi-judicial powers, something different. So I want to just say thank you for serving. Appreciate that. I want to say also that you're a terrific bunch of people, because I work on other boards, and sometimes we have boards that are not so great to work with. You guys are great to work with. We're also fortunate to have a really good staff here. You have a good your attorney. Hector has a lot of experience. I worked with Hector in Deltona before he came here. And I think it was at Altamont Springs before that, right? He has a lot of experience, and you're very fortunate to have Hector on board. And he's got terrific staff. So I want to say that now. We'll say it again later at the end of the day. But I want to say it now, and thank you again for serving and to serving the citizens. They don't realize, the citizens of Daytona Beach, how much work you do and how hard it is, but we appreciate it. So I'll be back to you. And again, if you have questions to me at any time, feel free to ask.
I think it will be beneficial. I would think that everyone knows all the members of our board, but if you can just, again, as we make an effort to, we all know each other, but as we have our public viewers, if we don't have your name tags or anything, just kind of introduce yourselves just for the public and how long you've been on the board.
Don Smart. How many years have I been on the board?
So it's like, that feels like forever.
Approximations are fine.
I don't think you had any gray hair then, but anyway. I think it was at least 4 years.
At least, yeah.
More than 4 years. Neil Harrington, about 7 years.
Richie Pandey, chair, and I think it's been 4 or 5 years.
Burton Weatherholtz, and I think that I'm the newest.
We're missing one person, Terry Jones.
And Charlie Cena, and I've been, was it 4 years, 5 years, something like that?
More than that. No, it's more. It's about eight now.
I don't remember. It's like a gold.
Yeah, it's been a long time. And as we're kind of going crosswise and out at Hector.
Hector Garcia, I'm the Neighborhood Services Manager. I've been with the city with Daytona Beach 5 years.
And Anthony Jackson, I'm the attorney for the board. I've been, not the attorney for the board, I'm attorney for code enforcement, the city. I had a period when I was attorney for the board, but I've been with the city and doing code enforcement now 17 years. So
we have Mr. Charles Bryant in the back.
Charles Bryant, redevelopment project manager. I've been with the city for 16 and a half years.
And he'll be presenting to you somewhere along this process as well as we all will be presenting to the staff. Okay, and so without any further ado, we'll go on to Hector, and Hector will tell us his portion of the presentation.
I'm sorry,
we left Amy back. I apologize, Amy.
Amy?
Everybody knows Amy. No.
Well, on top of being the board secretary, let me enlighten everybody a little bit. Amy does a valuable service to not only the Neighborhood Services Division, where she runs our special magistrate hearings, our code board, she does all the recordings, she does all the filings, and everything of that nature. On top of that, she's also Mr. Jackson's paralegal, and she has to keep up with all the foreclosures and everything else. It has to deal with the police department.
Forfeitures. That's close.
So she is overworked.
She is.
Underpaid. And a jack of all trades, and she is very valuable to our police department as well as the neighborhood services. All right, I think everybody here, does everybody have a copy of the anatomy of the code enforcement? Processing. You don't
need
a hand, I'll give you one.
There's some up there at the
front. Everybody has. So of course, code enforcement is the redheaded stepchild of the city. And I say that facetiously because we get all the complaints of properties, homes, junk vehicles. Now we're getting complaints about boats in the marina. Causeway, and anything that anybody can complain on, they send it to code. Whether it belongs to code or not, we get the calls. So when we get a call, the call gets it comes into code, and it gets recorded into a tracking system. Now, the tracking system can be a variation of different ways. It could be an email that's sent. We get an email, that's tracked because what we know is a public record. We get a complaint phoned in, we send out an email to the designated zone officer, and he or she will go out and investigate. So, if you look on the, looking at it, would be your left-hand side. At the top, it says complete, received, entered into tracking system, assigned to the inspector, investigate. That is the initial call coming in. The investigation can take anywhere between, it could be immediate or it could even take up to a week, depending on the caseload of the inspector. Once that's investigated, we go out, we attempt to make a verbal contact, meaning we try to contact the resident of the property and advise him or her of the violation. Per 162, Antonio, get into that. It doesn't necessarily mean that a notice of violation has to be given right then and there. If you make contact, my staff is directed, and for the most part, a lot of jurisdictions do it this way, and it's strongly recommended, this is that if you make verbal contact, make contact, and I'm going to use Donald as an example. I knock on his door. Donald's there. How you doing,
Mr. Smart, listen, you've got a vehicle that's parked on your grass. Against city code, please move it. My nephew's car, he's away, he's coming back tomorrow. I'll make sure that it's removed tomorrow. That's verbal contact. Okay? He tells me he's going to remove it tomorrow.
Thank you, Johnny.
As an inspector, I make a note that tomorrow I'll go by and see if Mr. Smart has the vehicle removed. I go back tomorrow, the vehicle is removed, case closed. End of discussion with that case. A week later, the car comes back, his nephew parks on the grass again. Now, I make verbal contact with Mr. Smart. Now I'm going to issue him a notice of violation because now I'm going to document, not that I didn't document before, but it was verbal contact, compliance was made. Boom, end of story. Now, in my eyes, it's a repeat violation. Just keep that in the back of your head for later on. I'm going to come up to Mr. Smart and say, here's a notice of violation. The vehicle's parked there. Got 24 hours to have it removed. Best case scenario, it gets removed. Worst case scenario, now we got to go to a non-compliance issue. 24 hours come up. The vehicle's not there. Mr. Smart refuses to open the door. Now we got to take it a step further. Say this happens today, okay, being June 29th. I have to issue what we call a CEV2, which is on the diagram here, which is a notice of hearing, an affidavit of violation. Today's the 29th. July 14th, if I recall correctly, is our next special magistrate hearing. Code hearing. And the cutoff has already been met. So Mr. Smart actually will have now the entire month of July, until the cutoff comes up where I have to now issue to Amy notice of noncompliance, and then a notice of hearing goes out. But in the interim, Mr. Smart lives in Pelican Bay. So his neighbors are pissed off at him because, A, the violation happened one time, he corrected it, and now it happened a second time, and now it's still sitting in the grass. So now my office is getting inundated with about 1,000 phone calls regarding that car. Code enforcement isn't doing nothing. The code enforcement is doing something. It's called a legal process, due process, which you'll hear more about later on throughout this presentation. So now we go into the non-compliance mode, and let's fast track this now. We go before the special magistrate, or we go before the sitting board that's here. Mr. Smart comes in, and he comes in to the board. He's no longer a board member. He's a violator. Comes in, and he says, my wife had triple bypass surgery. I couldn't get to the car. My nephew was deployed out to Iraq. That's why the car's been sitting there. Is that a reasonable excuse? Depends. But that's up to the board to decide. So the first time, they're going to come in and say, Mr. Smart, is that car parked on your grass? Yes, it is. Board hereby finds you in noncompliance. How much time is it going to take for you to come into compliance? Well, let me see. If I notify the U.S. commander of the United States Army, who's then going to notify the fleet admiral out in Iraq, may take me about 45 days. That's a possibility. And I'm throwing exaggerated numbers so that you all have an understanding of what this entails. So he says he needs 45 days. The board turns around and says, you know what, 15 days is enough. You got 15 days to get rid of the car, and you're good. So he gets rid of it in 15 days. That's a good case scenario. Bad case scenario is the one I said where he's got to make all these notifications, and he doesn't come into compliance. Now we've got to bring him before the code board again. But in the interim, the neighborhood's in an uproar because that vehicle's been sitting there for all this time. I'm getting the phone calls, the city manager's getting the emails, code enforcement isn't doing their job. But we are. It's documented. It's called a legal process. We can't just go and remove that car. So now we come down to another hearing, a second hearing. The board now has the decision to either fine him, extend time,
So we go here, compliance at the time, fines stop, or rather, I'm sorry, non-compliance, fines imposed at a subsequent hearing, which is now
another month.
Now a fine gets put in. But during that time, now he's being fined, the car leaves. Okay? Compliance at some time, fine stop, and the lien then gets recorded. So out of the 30 days, let's say, he got fined $100 a day. 30 days. No. Does that make sense?
No. Yeah, $100 a day, 30 days,
$3,000. $3,000, yeah. You got me mixed up with all those math equations there. $100 a day, 30 days, $3,000 fine. Amy then records the fine in the court, gets the filing fee, so forth and so on. The lien can either get paid or lien can get foreclosed, but now got to keep in mind, and Tony will get into that, with the foreclosure part, is it beneficial for the city to go after that property and foreclose on it for a $3,000 fine when he owes $195,000 on his mortgage? Something that's got to be taken into consideration. The other thing is he decides he's going to sell the house, the lien pops up. He files an application with us, with the city, and says, I'd like to go before the board for a lien reduction. The lien reduction then gets put on the agenda. We review it, staff. It's a $3,000 fine, the recording costs, time for us to go out there. If he pays us $1,500, which would be half, we'll let the other half go. He agrees to it. City gets $1,500 for the time put into it. We're good. His fine gets lifted. Good case scenario.
But he has to be in compliance. He can't.
Correct. And the way he gets into compliance is when the lien gets stopped, and we go out and verify that there's no other vehicle parked on the grass. Now, use the vehicle parking on the grass. That's not how that works with a vehicle parked on the grass. I'm just using that as a hypothetical situation. Okay? Vehicle parked on the grass, we can put a 10-day notice, so forth and so on, so there's other ways to get around it. So don't hold that scenario to the teeth. It's just an animated scenario so you all have an idea. And that's pretty much how a code case goes. Like I said, good code case is we go up, we talk to the owner, we get compliance, we achieve compliance immediately. Code enforcement was not designed to become a punitive action. It is not in any way, shape, form, or other, because I have many citizens, many residents, many property owners, business owners coming to me, but why can't he get fined? It's not designed or designated to be a punitive action. It is designed to gain voluntary compliance. That is one thing that we try to do. Now, in some cases last, and I've seen it here in Daytona, several years, yes, they can. There are people that have had cases. We had one case, for example. The minute I came on board, my staff came to me with this case. It was the trailer park on Madison and Beach. Okay. That case went on month after month, skipping 2-3 months after month, 3 years. Okay? That's the legal system. Some people and that individual happened to be a disbarred attorney who knew how to manipulate the system to his way. This board here, with the exception of our two new board members, sat with this individual at one point in time. The magistrate, he asked for a change. The magistrate then took it over. Everyone here that remembers that case was frustrated, including the people in the area. But unfortunately, there was nothing that we could do. Bottom line was, he did end up with a hefty fine. Developer came in, bought the property, removed all the trailers, brought the property into compliance. Thank God, knock on wood, until today, it's still in compliance. But that's just to show
the citizens in the audience and the new board members that some cases can get dragged out so long that the frustration level is not only at the citizens' part, but it's also on the staff's part. Because then we start, in a sense, second-guessing ourselves, and we start going over, did we do this right, did we do that right? And in a sense, we are doing everything right. It's just a process. So with that, any questions regarding a case from how we get it to how we get it to close?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Officer finds a case, contacts the owner. The owner, within one day, takes care of the problem. Should this appear on our agenda?
No. Well, what happens is, 9 times out of 10, and with that example that you did, let's just go back to parking. We get a complaint, parking. 24 hours later, he removes it. A week later, does it again. The officers have the discretion of writing them up right then and there, again, or they can turn around and say, you know what, I'm going to write you up, but then you're going to go before the magistrate or the code board, and we're going to find you in noncompliance so that if you do this again, then we can bring you automatically to the magistrate or the code board, and they can decide whether or not they're going to fine you. That's called a repeat violator, and I didn't get into that because your board attorney and Tony will get into the logistics of what a repeat violator is. I just did a cursory explanation of a case from beginning to end. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, would you like to explain to everyone that you are not the police?
Okay. Questions is for me to explain that we are not the police. There are certain things that code enforcement cannot do. Okay. Homeless people sleeping in a porch. Code enforcement cannot go up there and physically remove these people from the porch. Okay. We can't. But we get those complaints. We have to then turn it over to the police. The police can't just walk into somebody's property and physically remove them from the porch.
Correct.
Correct?
Correct.
The property has to get set up into what is called, and not every city has this, the trespass arrest program, which means the property owner now is authorizing the police to go onto his or her property, physically arrest anybody who's there who is trespassing and does not have the permission from the owner. That takes time. And you got to realize, the unfortunate situation is here in Daytona Beach is that we have a lot of out-of-state owners. And in some instances, it is out of, not only out-of-state, but it is out-of-country. Okay? I've had property owners live far north as Canada, and as far south as Venezuela. Now, to get a certified letter to Venezuela is going to take approximately 45 to 60 days. That's when the time clock starts ticking, when they sign for it, and we receive the green card. They'll get into that as well, the attorneys. So it's not cut and dry or as easy as, you know, people assume. It's like I said, one is time consuming if it's a case that's going to be problematic. If it goes through the due process and it goes through the length of time that it goes, it could take quite a while. A lot of properties get resolved within days, within a couple of weeks. Sometimes it even goes as far as we talk to a person, and my code officers have this discretion. They can go to Donald Smart, for example, and say he's got outside storage, he's got a dilapidated staircase, he's got broken windows, broken screens, rotten wood over the overhang. That's just the exterior, okay, that we can physically see. Because, again, we have certain boundaries that we can walk into. Code enforcement, you can only go into the common path. So if this is the front, to the front door, we can go up to the front door. Anything that we can visually see to the left or to the right of us is fair game. If I'm walking away and I see down and I see a boat that's, you know, half-cocked off the trailer and everything else, we can address it. I can't go into that backyard. That's law. OK? okay? We can't go into backyards, so if you call me and tell me that there's a green swimming pool, nobody's living there, we can't go into that backyard unless a neighbor from the side or directly behind gives us consent to go into their property and we can see. If they have an 8-foot privacy fence, you can't give me a chair and say, stand up and look over and you can see into it. The law says that's a no-no. I have to be able to hold a camera, eyes length, and take a picture. So if we can't see it, unless you got a 2-story home, and we can go up to your second floor and look down, can't do it. Anything else?
And just a little more clarification on that point without going getting overly legal on it. I think the real point there is that, and this is for everyone, the real point there is that sometimes citizens can do things that government can't do. Just because a citizen walked in someone's backyard and saw something doesn't mean that all officers will be able to go back there and see it. So, I mean, certain things, there's certain criteria that can make it rise to a level where it may be an exigent circumstance or some other issue, but in general, it's going to be a violation of someone's personal property rights, First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights for a government official to go back there or go in areas where they're not allowed to go. So that's the point. A citizen may see it, but unless they have a way for our guy to address it and see it, then it's really just knowledge that the citizen have, and even the citizen had probably trespassed, may have been illegal, but that's not something we're trying to resolve. There's no complaint from anyone about that, the fact that that citizen went in someone else's yard and saw the things that they saw.
Can you tell me what's involved in the trespass arrest program? Does the owner of the property then have to get papers issued?
What happened? That trespass arrest program is like an application. They have to fill out a form, get it notarized, send it into the police department, at which time a police officer goes out, does an inspection of the property, because by the property owner signing that paper, he or she authorizes the police to be able to go in to that property and check it and make sure that it's clear of vagrants or anybody that shouldn't be there. And what happens is the property gets posted that says it's under the no trespass and arrest program, at which time any police officer happens to be driving by and sees somebody sleeping on the porch, notices that the door's been broken open and it's open, he or she can go inside, check the house, and if somebody's in there, can arrest them right then and there. So does that answer your question?
And there's certain criteria.
Right.
And
criteria
when you contact them, they'll tell you that criteria as far as, you know, when it's vacant and those types of things, if it's a business, what operating hours, because we can't. Obviously, if a business is open, we can't really
right.
do that. But when it's closed or when someone's home is vacant, that's the more practical application of when we utilize the trespass arrest program.
Yeah, it's touchy.
I'm sorry?
It's touchy if you have a bunch of kids or relatives.
Yeah,
no,
but that's true.
But
our officers are well, you know, they're well trained on when they...
Unfortunately, maybe Tony can... touch base of this is that if somebody, let's just use a hypothetical, the house has been abandoned, and now all of a sudden Billy Bob and Sally Jane took possession of the house. And when I say took possession of that house, it's that they have been living there. Okay? They're squatters, exactly. Although Mr. Smart owns the house and he never authorized them to live there, Mr. Smart has to go through the eviction process in order for that property to now go into the arrest trespass program. And in order for code enforcement to do anything, we have to go after him. So whether they have water...
And the owner.
And the owner.
When you say him, who is
the owner?
The owner.
Right. I pointed to Donald. Sorry. You go after the owner. Donald Smart. We have to go after him. So they have no electricity. The Amish have no electricity. You know, running water. What constitutes running water? You know what? If I can pour it down the toilet bowl and it flushes, that's running water. They tell me
you know, I'm going to pick on Amy now because I'm looking at it. Amy says, they don't have running water. Well, how do you know? Well, they let me inside. Okay. They let you inside. They didn't let me inside, so I can't tell if they got running water or not. Now, can we go through the utilities? Absolutely. Utilities have been turned off. They have no running water, per se, from the city. But Neil, who's squatting there, says to me, I got water. Look at the 5-gallon jugs. I don't have to let you inside. Okay. That's it. So there's a lot of different things that the citizens don't know, and sometimes they come before you as a board and they utilize that as an excuse, you know, to get sympathy from you. And you know, it just makes our job difficult, and for you as board members, you all have to make that determining factor. Thank God, you know, you got Tony Jackson on our side for us, and you got Charlie over there who helps when these cases come up. But it does. Yes, ma'am.
So what is the remedy? You have a neighbor with a slimy green swimming pool with clouds of Zika mosquitoes hovering around. You can't go in the backyard, and you can't peer over the 8-foot privacy fence. What is to be done about the hazardous conditions in the unattended
school? First off, the city doesn't have anything to do with mosquito control or anything like that.
Oh, I realize
so
that.
If I get that phone call, I refer it to the county. The county handles mosquito control and all that.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting
that. What we do is we try to, one way or another, we try to convince a neighbor, let us into your backyard so we can see that situation, but you've got to realize, first thing out of people's mouths is, I don't want to get involved. I don't want him coming after me. Depends on the area. But we, my staff, tries to do the best we can. We go left, and I'm going left this way, which is your left. Left, right, and we go behind. If I can't get into that backyard, legally I don't know what I can do. I have to then turn to my legal attorney and see a way if we can get back there. Thank God we haven't had that situation. But realize, if the city has to board that up, we had to board up a swimming pool not too long ago, and it cost the city over $4,000 for one swimming pool to be boarded up.
So there is no remedy unless you get a neighbor to give you access to a place where you can observe the condition of the swimming pool.
Tony, I defer to you on that.
But usually that neighbor is the one that's complaining about it. Is more than willing to let you take a look at the pool, so that doesn't happen. The problem, what happens is we get these pools, and we can't find anybody. Even if we know that they're in violation and we have a fine running, and just can't let that pool stay there because kids get drowned. So what happens is, it ends up happening is the cities have to go spend the public money to secure those pools. And that's not even that works temporarily. 5, 6, 7 years down the road, things rot, wood gets moved, and you're back in that same situation again. So usually in those kind of situations, the neighbors will work with us, work with code enforcement. But, it's a no-win situation. Because once we know about it, once it's a code violation, we just can't let it sit there and nothing happen. Because somebody gets hurt, first thing they're going to do is going to sue the city.
There's, and as Charlie's saying, there's no one fix. Sometimes you're in a situation where you have to assess it from a legal perspective and use all the legal remedies you have available. And there may be alternative remedies, and we just have to search those remedies out. But it starts with being able to see and know that there's a violation. And like Charlie said, typically someone who knows it, they're doing it as a complaint, and then they have access that's a lawful access. You know, I mentioned a moment ago that sometimes you have unlawful access, and that becomes a challenge for us on how we know about it if the only way you know about it is because you had some unlawful access. But typically the report comes from someone with lawful access where they can see it from their yard or from somewhere else, and they can invite the inspector to do the same.
Thank you. While we're on this subject, do you want to address what happens when a case comes before us and there are multiple violations? If there's one violation that threatens life, then the board may request that the city authorizes code enforcement to go put a stop to whatever it is that's causing that life-threatening situation. The other violations, though, still sit there. I mean, every case is different.
Right. And I guess what we're really doing now is we're transitioning here, and this is good. And that's because what's next on the agenda is for me to cover, as a brief overview, the duties, responsibilities of the process. And I think we have that up there. So in doing that, my intent on how we will do that is that I'll just sit and tell you the process by statute. And if we want to jump around, we can. Like the question you're asking, we can talk about that. And I want this to be a free and open conversation where if Charlie has something to say, it's not a presentation, but it's information, it's a conversation. So if Charlie has something to say, I'd like him to say that. And if Hector has something to say, and if you have any questions on the process where we can, and it may trigger something as we're going through the statute in general, but it's the process that I'd like us to be able to talk about. So why don't I start with just what you asked about, and just as a point for especially the newer members of the board, because these situations come up, and as you said, they're not circumstances that are always a quick and easy remedy. You have a property that comes before the board, and instead of just one or two issues, you have a slew of, you know, if you could say tear down, that may be the easiest statement, but what our staff has to do is identify the violations and allow people an opportunity, if they so choose, to remedy those violations. So they list all of the violations, and it can be a laundry list, as you know, of violations. Well, some of those things, it's easy to see that it'll take some time, and you may want to allow someone that additional time, maybe 60 days or 90 days. But then there's other aspects of the violations that may be what we would call life safety issues, or issues of great concern. They don't always have to be specifically life safety, but generally the issues of great concern are life safety. And so you would typically bifurcate an order. You'd have a portion of the order that deals with those issues. And so that you'd ask for an order that says, okay, for that electrical system that's messed up and the plumbing that's flowing on the ground and this item, we need that taken care of in the next 10 days or the next 30 days even. But and then you can worry about these other things. We'll give you 60 days for that, but this stuff we want you to take care of now. And so you just have an order that deals with those issues separately. So, yes.
I have a question. I don't know whether I should ask Hector or you.
Ask us.
We have an individual who works for the fire department, David Newell.
Okay, we're not. Oh, okay, yeah, as our inspector. Okay. That's cool. Yeah.
Okay, but does he have more authority about going in than our other code enforcement officers?
Yeah, code enforcement, as you know, is, and maybe I should be going through this now, because code enforcement is anyone that's been given the authority to enforce the codes of the city. But they may have other authority that's been granted through state law or in other areas. So specifically, a fire inspector has state law authorities that allow them to do things that may be broader than what our code inspectors, our general code inspectors can do. And so his while he's wearing his hat as fire inspector, then he can do extra stuff. Now, he's still a code inspector because he's been designated and authorized to operate as a code inspector and handle citing the code violations, but his principal role is to go in and deal with the fire safety matters. And so that's, in that sense, you're right. He would have greater authority on those types of matters.
And if I could interject here, as a fire inspector, he has the authority to do inspections on commercial properties. So single-family residence, he has no jurisdiction over. That's per state statute. So again, you know, we get the term, and it's been thrown out there, well, why can't the fire inspector shut them down? Why can't he make them do this? This is a single-family resident, or it's a two-family resident. He can't. Four and above, he has the right to shut down and do whatever. Less than four, he can't.
There are also some things that the building official, I think he's here, can do that to that he gets under state statute that here he is. He gets under state statute that we can't that he can do that are separate above what we do here.
I think one of our board members is a former building official, correct?
Yes.
So maybe could you enlighten us on what the building official has the authority?
Well, we will have our
situation
first
on that. But for now, to answer Neil, so he has an idea. Not Neil, Donald, so he has an idea.
Well, you know, most of the things that I was involved with was commercial. And I think the biggest thing was capacity of restaurants, public venues, whatever the capacity was, possibly being there with the fire department, and keeping that under control, especially bingo and special events like that, it seemed to be always a problem. If there's a fire violation, naturally, the fire department would usually take care of it. As far as special authority, it was mostly on fire issues, and the fire inspector handled it. You know, some building, you know, violations, but the code enforcement, some of the things that we've had lately, safety, anything that involves safety.
And I don't know if it's fair on Mr. Weatherholtz, because there are certain things that we do specifically here that's authorized through our codes and ordinances,
yes,
that may be things that Ms. Weatherholtz wasn't doing. And so when we have, remind me of the name.
Glenn Vance.
No, it's not Glenn.
Yeah.
Urquhart.
There you go. Yeah. Glenn Urquhart.
Glenn, yeah. So when we have Glenn come back at 3 o'clock from permits, we'll see the way that we're addressing some of those things as his presentation. One of the things I like to, if we take a look back and just bringing a little order to how what I wanted to do in terms of presenting to you guys, is that one of the first things as you look at the statute under 16202 is that the first emphasis in statutes is the intent. I mean, why are you here anyway? Why do we do this, what we do? And you have a copy of that and tab C in your those who have a set. I guess that would be the board members. If you want to take a look at that, but it's also up here for everyone else. That the intent, in its simplest statement, it's a little bit longer than that in the statute, but it's to promote, to protect, and to improve the health, safety, and welfare. That's what we're all doing this code enforcement for. You know, and we know that we have what we don't want to be doing it for, and we always are being cautious and careful, is to get back, because we're mad. Or, you know, sometimes you have people who make code complaints for the wrong reason, you know, but we're forced to have to still go out and deal with them. But when you're dealing with them as a board, you still want to ask yourself, what are we here for? We're here to promote, protect, and improve the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of our city, state, and county. So for us, it's the city. And so, And what we're trying to do is provide an equitable, expeditious, effective, and inexpensive method of enforcing. Now, when I talk methods, that's something that's important for the board to recognize, is that the method of enforcing is not necessarily within your purview. What they do to fix it, other than knowing that it's fixed and knowing that, you know, in good faith, if they tell you they're going to do something, whether they did it or not. Sometimes people tell you they'll do something, and they may do less than that, but they still may fix the problem. And when it's all said and done, what you're evaluating is, did they come into compliance? Did they fix the problem?
Yeah, again, just that's an important point that he brought out. So I'll interrupt him a second. We are not to tell people how to fix the problem. We end up doing it all the time. Right. And not just you, but the other boards do the same thing. Because what happens is, when you tell people to do something, and they end up taking your advice and they do it, and then you come after them, well, you told me to do this, and then I did it, now you're coming after me. I had a situation that happened last week where a board member told an individual what to do. Outside, he was outside, wasn't anything to do with us. He outside of the board. He was the board member. This individual came to the board member to hire the board member. The board member did not accept the did not get hired by this person. But at the meeting said, well, you told me when I met with you that if I did this, I wouldn't be in violation.
Careful, guys.
Real problem. Big problem. Big problem. And first of all, the board member should not be soliciting business from the people he comes in front of him. And secondly, I told him at that point to get up and get out. The board member and the individual, and talk about this outside the meeting. It has nothing to do with this meeting. And, you know, so what I'm trying to say to you is that we need to stay away from that issue. Do not tell people what to do. It's not easy sometimes. We feel sorry for these people. We want to help them. Don't.
And something that
that's what Hector's people can sit down with them and tell them what the violation is and how they can come into compliance, well, not us.
Something that Ouija's been effective with, and Chair's before you as well, but Ouija's been very effective with it, is when getting to that point where you finally look at them and say, you're going to need to get with the staff. You need to get with the staff and see. Because that's really the ultimate. Their role is to solve it. They need help. Then they should be coming to the staff to help them. If you got a complaint because the staff isn't helping you, then you go to the city, or, you know, the city chain of government to say, I'm not getting the help I need from your staff. But none of that is within the board's jurisdiction. The only thing the board is able to do is ultimately make a decision based on the facts that are presented, the evidence that you're given, make a decision on whether or not this person, first of all, are you in compliance or not. One, is there a violation? Yes, no. Yes, there's a violation. Here's what we would like you to do.
The idea is to give
based on
Hector,
the information they receive.
What Hector brought up is the due process. We want to give each citizen that comes in front of us due process. Because we do not have to agree with the city. We feel there's no violation. We can say there's no violation. It doesn't happen very often. But every once in a while, we may feel something's not a violation that they feel is a violation. So, and that's why we're not only a quasi-judicial, but we're independent of the city. The city commission cannot never happened before, but the city commission cannot go ahead and say, well, I don't like what the code board did, which we're going to go ahead and reverse their decision.
And what Charlie's saying in another way is that what the statute tells us is that the action of the code board is the final administrative action.
Right.
It's the last opportunity. When they came to you, if you made a decision and you're done, then you're done. If they don't like your decision, they have to go to the circuit court. They have to leave the administrative body and go to the circuit court to get another answer. And that's through appeal, which is the section.
In 30 days.
I mean, I get to. They got 30 days to go file an appeal with the circuit
with
court.
With a certiorari.
Well, we disagree. there's always
writ of appeal.
Discussion that, right. It's a writ of appeal. Some of them file writs of cert. The court's fine with either one.
Yeah.
That they both handle the same way.
What evidence is, or should I put it? We've had several cases where I don't know what the law of slander and libel is, but we have people not testifying about the infraction, but calling the people drug dealers, swine, the devil. We waste a lot of time. I don't know that we should be listening to that. I think they're out of order.
I think we can hear from.
I mean, right. We shouldn't be dealing with personalities. And hopefully, in the future, if that happens again, our chairperson will gavel them down. But We're there to determine the merits of the case,
right.
Not determine the people's personalities or character.
What it's brought to you from our standpoint, when we bring it to you, the presentation is we're showing you the evidence of the pictures.
Right.
Now, the city can't control what
somebody
else is going to say. However, you all, and basically it falls on the chair, you all control the hearing process and how that hearing is going to be run and how people are going to act when it's going to be conducted. So if you feel, the chair, that someone is out of line, you or even one of the board members can say, Madam Chair, I feel that this individual is out of line. Can we please move on? And you can do that. However, realize that people get animated and they get overzealous because they have a passion about what they're coming to you to complain about. Okay? And unfortunately, we can't control that. It's pretty much like I was saying to you where, you know, my staff gets, you know, my division is getting inundated with phone calls because we're not doing anything about that junk vehicle. But unbeknownst to them, the people that are calling, and we try to explain it to them, they don't want to hear it, is that, you know what, is a thing called due process. We are working on the case, and we are doing what we can do and what the law allows us to do. I can't just walk onto somebody's property and do whatever or make corrections. Now, just to touch upon what Tony said before is, yes, we are here, my staff is here to guide people, but I cannot make any type of recommendations. You need to call Joe's Plumbing and he can help you with this. That needs to be adamantly clear. We do not do that.
And we do not do that.
Tell somebody, I'm not going to tell somebody, and nor is my staff, you know, instead of putting PVC pipe, instead of putting copper pipe, you put PVC. That's not our level of expertise. We don't have that level of expertise. To go up on somebody's roof and say, well, this has a, you know, particle board instead of plywood or anything like that, that's not our level of expertise. That's what inspectors are for. And even though my staff is called code enforcement inspectors, we are not state certified in plumbing, electrical, roofing, general contracting, any of that.
Now, with that being said,
we have staff that does.
Yeah, recognize that you have a right to want to know if that's an important part of someone being in compliance. And we would have the duty and responsibility to get answers for you. We'll present the answers, and I say we, but the staff would present, and they'd do that through me. One of the things, though, what we were talking about as well, with the whole aspect of presentation and respect, we try and, in fact, we dealt with this in a recent training with staff as well, is one of the reasons we have the manner in which we present now, which was not always the way we did it, but where attorney presents and then staff comes up, is we try and build a decorum so that the citizens or those who come behind us can follow with respecting the board, giving proper acknowledgement of the chair, and those types of things, so that someone else who comes up don't stand there and get rude or disrespectful. And then when they do, as you say, if the chair calls them down, I think that kind of nips it in the bud. But we really try and work hard at saying, okay, we're here for this, and we've addressed this. And if we somehow get out of line, as Charlie say, we don't have to be on the same page. So, I mean, you can call us, you know, call the staff down as well and say, well, that's not, you know, in whatever manner in which you choose to do that. I couldn't tell you the words to say. But I don't think that we've had that as a problem. I appreciate what the, you know, the staff has worked hard to do their best to be consistent in presenting in the same manner so that they're understood. And if we get confused, then it's usually me with the one that's spinning around trying to help us not be so confused. But we try to keep that order.
Yeah, what we're not supposed to be is a rubber stamp for the city. Yeah, most they do an excellent job, and I would say 99% of the time they present excellent cases. And, you know, we're here. The idea of due process is we need to catch that one time when they're not. And fortunately, it hasn't happened very often because they do their homework. But well, let me just kind of step back a second. Years ago in the city, maybe in the 70s and 60s and 50s, we had city judges. And they would take care of everything. They would handle code enforcement. They'd handle traffic. They'd handle criminal cases. They'd handle everything. Plus, people got along sometimes better with each other. You know, they wouldn't do, you go talk to your neighbor and try to work something out. In 1972, people voted for, in the state of Florida, an old new court system. They had the Supreme Court, District Court of Appeals, the County Court, and the Circuit Court. And what happened was code violations were supposed to be a part of the County Court. Well, it didn't happen that way. We were ignored. There was no more code violations being adjudicated by anybody. County Court was saying, we're too busy with traffic and criminal. We don't have time for the cities. So what happened was the legislature, and I guess it was the early 80s, decided we've got to do something for the cities. They've got to be able to enforce their codes. And I think it was 84 or 85, something like that, or 80. They came up and they adopted the code for the, I think it was from a pilot project that was going on, I think, in Palm Beach County.
Right.
They've come up with a code board. That's where they came up with the idea of the code enforcement board, and they gave you the powers that they give you under 162 to do what you do. But there was a lack of anybody dealing with any code violation in the state of Florida until we had the board. And surprisingly enough, the board has had a great success rate statewide. It's in the 90s. Sometimes you don't even get the 90s in the court system. You don't get that high of a success rate. But the idea with the whole idea of the idea is with the code board was to work with people to try to get compliance. We're not punitive. I'm here to punish people. We're here to get compliance. And sometimes it takes 3 years to get compliance. But we end up with compliance. Makes it better for the city, makes it better for the community, and brings the tax rolls up a little bit more for the city. There's a whole bunch of good things that happen when code is enforced. And, you know, we're not trying to be another police department. But on the other hand, knowing that we're here and knowing that we have the ability to find people if necessary, it gives them the authority to go out and do what they do.
And although I think she may have applicability, maybe she want to hit on that, you know, although we also have a special magistrate program and we balance between the two, and a lot of jurisdictions have gone completely special magistrate only. But that's not what the city has elected to do, because one of the things that the city recognizes is the value of a citizen board and the input of people who are people who go through the city, see these things on a regular basis. When we flip over and talk a little bit about, you know, ex parte communication and all those types of things, one of the things that goes along with all those whole ideas is recognizing that you are part of the city. You're there. You see things. Certain things are presumed knowledge that's, you know, just part of the fact that you're in the city. And so you have to balance that while you're working at making sure you're not creating biases that make you unfair. But at the same time, still recognizing that the city is familiar to you, and that's useful, and that's important.
Can we go back to Neil's question? Is that, I don't know what that case isn't over.
I don't know what he's
okay.
Keep it general.
Just general. Yeah.
But one of the reasons that I allowed so much conversation from witnesses, because I wanted to get a lot of things on the record. And I agree that in some instances, maybe it was too much time and too much repetitive stuff, but it all went to the general condition and the general, I thought it went to the general complaint and that was brought before us. So I don't know where that cutoff is between where you're saying what witnesses, because we don't. That's something I'm not real clear on is whether is witnesses.
That's my question.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe we need a little bit of explanation about that.
Well, let me just say this first of all: the value of having a chair. You know, we have to recognize that there's a someone has to be able to be a decision maker, and someone has to use a judgment, and we just have to follow your judgment I'm talking for the board, not the staff, you know. You have to follow your judgment, whether it would be what I would do or not, it's not the issue. That's what you've done, and they follow you, and that's what makes it work. Y'all can fight about it in discussion, but, you know, they follow you. And
well,
there's some value.
It's not that. It's the legal issue. We discuss amongst ourselves, you know, an issue. But what we need is a legal issue, you know, because there's something going on and the neighbors. They might have been the one that called you. So they want to come up. And so we, you know.
And that's what I was about to say. And this is when you turn to your attorney.
The problem is that we're quasi-judicial board. And when someone presents a case, the case is presented by the code people, it should be their witnesses that are coming up. Or if a citizen comes in and says, well, I want to bring my witness, it shouldn't be a general free-for-all. Anybody wants to just bash their neighbor can go up and bash their neighbor. It should be witnesses called by the city or witnesses called by the violator. That's all you should. Anybody else that wants to speak shouldn't speak. This is not a public hearing where we're allowing the public to go in and talk about issues. This is a quasi-judicial hearing.
If I may, I think what Neil's gearing towards is that, again, there was a, and it's happened a few times.
A few times.
Yeah.
It's where it's a witness per se for staff, but he or she gets animated to the point where now they're...
It's a platform.
It becomes a platform for them. So we can't control that. Yeah. And the other thing is that you'll take somebody, for example, the violator, will have a witness, and now he or she decides they're going to use that platform to thrash staff and the city and everything else. That's where you, as the chair, Madam Chair, come into play, and you have to put an end to it.
Now, and understand, the easiest thing is to be able to turn to your attorney and say, hey, should I, you know, you can do that if you want. And just if I could say this, so my general perspective, and this is just Tony Jackson, this is not a rule, is that, and I hear what Charlie's saying, he's absolutely right, but because you're in a citizen forum, there may be a certain leash that you may, you know, of allowing at least someone to express. And I say that when I first started as prosecutor with misdemeanor prosecutions, the real solution for many misdemeanor prosecutions was allowing people to come to a judge, getting it off their chest, having a judge or person of wisdom say, okay, now this is what you need, you know, this y'all settle down, take care of this, do that, and then kind of takes care of it. But it's a judgment call, and it's not an easy one.
Maybe I'm a little off here on this, but I think we do an excellent job on that. And most times, when it do happen occasionally, if the chair doesn't do it, our attorney will say, okay,
yeah, Charlie Kessler
said,
yeah.
And I say,
the typical.
And I don't think Neil brought it up as a question. I don't think he's saying it as criticism.
No,
he's just
trying
to clarify how can we somewhat conform into not having more of this happen. And that's a roll of the dice. Unfortunately, in that situation, we don't know what, you know, Hector Garcia, citizen who lives over on the beach side, is going to say about Donald Smart, who lives over on the beach side.
Right.
You just don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Our
but
expectation is that they talk about the case.
Yeah, they're going to be doing the right thing.
Exactly.
And when
that's
they get off,
expect. Exactly.
Kind
when
of
they get off,
steer them back.
You got to steer them
steer
back
them.
Into.
We've had at least three cases where the people have come up. Joe Blow is a drug dealer. He's doing that. And they don't offer any proof. And it's in public record.
But here's the other thing. It's not about Joe Blow being a drug dealer or, you know, Sally Jane being a prostitute or, you know, Tom Jones being over here as a drug user. That's not what we're here for. We're here for the code case.
Right.
It is a code case. It is a civil matter. It's not a criminal court here or anything else. So,
and I was just going to be no dress in criminal court or somewhere else, and it very well may be. So,
and we will try, Tony and I will try to help you in that area and lead you. What I don't want to happen, don't want to do, is I don't want to become the eighth member of the board.
Yeah. Right.
That's your responsibility.
Right.
So we can't, you know, we always
you
can't interrupt.
You all have to communicate amongst yourselves.
Right.
Right.
So if something like that, and I'm just going to use a hypothetical, putting myself outside of staff. I'm sitting on the board, Mr. Weatherspoon and I are looking at each other, and we're like, okay, you know, I think we've had enough of this. Madam Chair, can we please move on?
Call the question, right, or whatever.
You know, they're going off course. Or I, as a staff member, may look at the chair and, you know, give you some sort of hint like, okay, enough. You know, they've had their say, now let's move on.
Yeah. One of the things that I think everybody recognizes is that when people come to the code board, whether they're the violator or the presumed violator or whether they are a witness, they're bringing a whole lot of frustration with them.
Yes.
And that, you know, it gets dicey sometimes, and you just have to do the best you can and use the best judgment you can in those situations. But so are we to then, if we allow witnesses to ask, you know, if there are people in the audience that come to testify, do we ask you if they can testify, or do they come up to you and say, I want to testify, or?
Yeah, they should be. If they're not brought as a witness of the other side, then if they're my witness, I should know that they want to testify.
Okay.
Either my either the staff is telling me,
okay,
this person. Now, I get caught with, the first time I ever heard they wanted to testify was while I was standing there,
right,
and I have no idea what they're going to say.
Right.
And that's not always the best thing. If you ask any attorney, you never want the first people testifying when you don't know what they're going to say. But again, recognizing, you know, as you say, one, you got people who may have legitimate knowledge and input,
right,
but they also may be very frustrated,
right,
and you know, and they haven't been brought into the realm of,
mm-hmm,
this is what you're allowed to do. You're not going to go talk about that type, you know, conversation. So that's why when you're kind of left, and really, it's almost an unfair thing because I'm tossing them out to you guys without having sat down and say, what do you want to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
But for me to not allow them to be heard, I will hear about it probably at the next commission meeting or somewhere else,
right,
you know, publicly,
yeah,
that I didn't,
yes,
allow them to be heard,
right,
when they had an issue that they thought was
a
great important.
Well, the way to address that is if in the beginning of the meeting I say, if there are witnesses that are want to testify in a case, please come forward and sign in, or, you know, before the meeting starts.
Well, you don't want to
do that. Because,
yeah, no.
Think about it a second. Could you imagine a judge going up there and hearing a case and saying, okay, anybody in the audience want to testify?
No.
You have to cover a fine line,
right,
between those people who are going to help us in making our decision,
right,
and the people who just want to go out and vent. And we've got to be real careful about that. This is not, we're a quasi-judicial board. We're not like everybody else. It's not a public hearing.
Right.
Okay.
That's what and my job is to make sure our staff understands the limits so that they're going out and when someone's, I got this lady out here, if they've already spoke to the lady and they know what she,
right,
what her information is.
What's happened lately is this, too. And we've had cases where an individual will come to us and say, or we'll ask them, are you willing to come and testify? Because, again, there are certain times that in certain cases, we don't see the violation.
Right.
It could have happened at 9:30 at night. We don't work 24 hours,
right,
a day.
Right.
So, you know, Sally down the street saw the violation. She's going to come. But now because Sally's coming, well, here comes Jane, and here comes Edward, and here comes Tom, and they all want to have something to say. But I'm only aware of Sally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's up to you as a board chair and say, okay, I think we've had enough.
Okay.
We've heard enough evidence and leave it at that. And then now you can cut the last two off, so to speak.
Right.
But that's what's been happening lately. And the situation that Neil's referring to, that's just an individual who's got a lot of pent-up frustration.
Right.
And he happens to be the violator. And now he wants to deflect by pointing the finger at the other people and try to make himself look like the victim.
Yeah, and I can think of some specific situations when you were very good at how you handled someone that was doing that. So, yeah, it's your tool and use it. if we could move to... Okay.
You may be planning on covering this, if you are, just say so. The special magistrate, I know we've referred to... And I'm not sure why we do that or when it's appropriate.
Certainly. The statute provides for a special magistrate if a city elects to appoint a special magistrate in whatever criteria they utilize, that a special magistrate, it, whenever appropriate, is equal to, in terms of their function and the rules, equal to the code board. So in terms of what they do, they do the same thing that the code board does collectively, but they're just an individual. And so some of our cases, with no real strict criteria, but some of our cases are given to the special magistrate, others are given to the code board, and I guess that's the gist of it.
It seemed like the one case that I observed, they were wanting the magistrate.
I remember which one you're talking about, and in that situation, well, actually, I'm thinking of one just the opposite.
Is there advantage to do that?
Not necessarily. but we don't appoint it based on their election. We're appointed usually, I think, what Ms. Hampton does is just based on the balance of the agenda and, you know, certain types of cases, maybe like, you know, certain of the commercial type case or some that may be more, well, complex in the sense of the some of the legal issues related to, you know, crime or other things or police. Or we'll just like a lot of the adult cases was when we really started doing the magistrate, just because the nature of the case, the nature of the material that was being presented wasn't really best presented for the general board. But it's not really set for, we don't have a set rule on how they're appointed. Just Ms. Hampton, do the best you can to lay them out to keep it equal. And because the city has elected to have both the magistrate and the board, then we balance out the cases in the manner that we think is appropriate. And I say we don't, like to say, I don't even have a part in that. It's just Ms. Hampton managing the docket. In the same way that clerks manage the docket at the county, for county court. Yes, ma'am. That's correct.
And is there a specific set of criteria that determines, you know, this way or that way?
Correct. No, there is not.
So what I'm hearing is there are no criteria?
That's correct.
And who decides then that it gets assigned this way or that way?
Simply case management. And so it's being managed by the board secretary. She assigns them based on case management.
Totally within the discretion.
At times, I have some input. Let me interject to that. At times, I have some input.
Does the alleged violator have an opportunity to say, I'd rather be at the special magistrate rather than
No.
Don't play the reform shuffle.
You're on a regular court. You don't get to pick and choose. I don't like Judge A, so I want to go to Judge C.
Oh,
however, I mean, you can have a circumstance where someone may recuse, you know, the magistrate or and we've had that situation arise where there was a conflict, and because of the conflict, then it went to the board,
right,
where it may have already even had started with the magistrate until the conflict was determined. So, yes.
How broad the discretion is and what the potential for arbitrariness is.
Yeah.
Arbitrariness as far as what, ma'am?
Determining, if you have two cases that are essentially similar in many respects,
there is no reason.
There is no reason.
The reason is case management.
Isn't that the
so the case management is if the magistrate has 20 cases on and the board has 15, then 16, 17, 18, 19 will go to the board. So there is no per se reasoning who's getting what.
So are you going before him just like you do us?
Yes.
Same way we go before you. The only difference is we go before one individual and then that's on Tuesday. That Thursday of the same week, we come before you.
Now, are there
different cases?
Are there ever, like, we got one that was turned over to the magistrate.
Right, and that was because the defendant filed a motion. Brought before the board.
Yeah, we had one half that was just the way it was laid out, it ultimately had a portion that had to be recused and not the whole case. So the portion that had to be recused, you heard, but then the other portion remained where it started.
Well, what is the advantage to having two of them? Why would you have that in this?
Well, it's not.
I'll tell you, from my standpoint, having 20 cases heard on Tuesday and being there until 12 o'clock is exhausting enough to where now, come Thursday, we're going to be there till 10, 11, 12 o'clock with you also. So it just splits up the time frame. Doesn't conclude that just being there at a full 8 hours of just doing cases by case by case. I look at it as that vantage point. The other thing is that, you know, we're working within our community with the board, and we also have the magistrate who's doing the cases as well.
Okay.
He's
a paid employee, right? Yes.
No, he's not an employee. No, not an employee. He's not an employee. And
that's the biggest thing that they want to know is how you pick the magistrate.
Who? David Kelja.
Yeah, David Kelja is the magistrate.
David Kelja is our special magistrate.
And there's a criteria in the code on how magistrate, in most jurisdictions as well as our jurisdiction, the magistrate, the special magistrate has to be an attorney. And beyond that, it's something where it would go before commission based on someone's making that suggestion. Usually, I think it's appointed or nominated by the city attorney because of the city attorney manages all legal matters for the city. But ultimately, that person is appointed by the commission.
And no, I have no connection to the special magistrate. No. My job is just the board.
Right. We pay for Mr. Sino to advise the code board, and then we pay, I think it's about the same salary for the magistrate to sit as the magistrate for those hearings.
Oh, so, but they're not, the magistrate is not a city employee.
No.
He's just paid for his time in the same manner that Mr.
Yes, he's paid, and we are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But as an attorney, he sometimes has more legal knowledge than we would have in a case that may be
a bit more complex. I guess would be. I mean, that was the best phrase. It's a bit more complex.
I have something that I know there is no cure-all for this, but a lot of times we get wherein, and I know that the owner is just supposed to let the new owner know that there's a complaint or there's a code violation. And even sometimes when you get into the lien, it's amazing how they can have a closure. But due to so many short sales, I think for some reason that notice gets lost. And the person that purchased the property does not know that there's a lien on it. Although I think this would be very fair when they find out that they didn't know. But do you think there's any way or anything that the city can do to, like, put it on there that they are, that they would know that there was a violation or no?
Yeah, what we do is, we record it.
That's what I said. That with the short sale and the concert, you still know it. It didn't show up. And because I remember asking our attorney how this did not show up, but it did not show up.
So if you don't do a title search, you may not. Nothing may show up.
Right. Yeah.
So and it's done behind.
Right.
And quality of the title search. Sometimes some. It's not all that uncommon for them to have to re-foreclose when something's missed. It's not that it doesn't happen. It happens more often than not. I won't say it happens often, but more often.
Amy's looking at us.
Yeah, what Ms. Hampton's suggesting is that we take a break, because I think we only have one break that's on the agenda at least. And so why don't we go ahead and take I think we said 15, but make it 10. Maybe, in fact, even better, 5. So take a 5-minute break. I may have to go to the restroom or something else, or make a phone call. We're going to get flowing again so we can get this back up. What we'd like to do is, and I know we have a lot more of the questions in here where we were, but it's real important for the board for some of the things that Charlie needed to cover for you guys in terms of instruction and training. So I'm going to look to Charlie to cover that, and then at some point we'll swing back to what I was handling. But we'll go on and hear what Charlie's going to share. We'll bring in the other divisions, and then we'll get back to the rest of the general process.
And we hope we don't leave without a good discussion of the last item on the agenda. The permits.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And we have a representative.
No rationale.
Certainly.
Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, many years ago there was a code board meeting that occurred in DeLand. And one of the individuals on the code board decided to pass a note to the chairman of the code board. The person that was actually being, the case for being the violator at the time, was so offended by that individual passing the note that the violator went to the newspaper, the Orlando Sentinel. The Orlando Sentinel went to the state attorney's office and has a full-scale investigation about that note. You know what the note was? Can we have a bathroom break? That was what the note was. Can we have a bathroom break? And it went all the way to the state attorney's office because of that one little note. So what I'm trying to say to you is that that's why we have rules. We have the Sunshine Law, the Public Records Law, the Code of Ethics Law, quasi-judicial rules, and we've gone over these things many times, but I just want to go over them real quickly. Number one, is the idea is you all understand what the Sunshine Law is. And the Sunshine Law says, basically, do not talk to each other in private about matters that could foreseeably come in front of the board. Okay? That's basically the bottom line. If you run into each other at Publix or you run into each other at a city function, you know, you can talk about anything else, just don't talk about things that are in front of you or could come in front of you. Okay? Real simple. I know it's real simple, but people getting violated that all the time. Again.
If I could say just the point you just made, though, when you started, which is sometimes it can be completely innocent.
Right.
So even at appearance is what you got to be careful of. Not only that you don't have the conversation, but be very cautious and knowledgeable about the fact that how it may appear. So even though you may be talking about something innocent, if it's going to give the appearance that you're talking about something that's improper, it'd be nice to know that someone else was listening in to hear what you're talking about. So just keep that in mind. I mean, you bump into someone in Target, it's nice to know that someone else heard the conversation so no one walks away thinking you were talking about their case. So while you may be absolutely okay, you may still have people who take a perception that you did it wrong. And that's what happened with this passing the note that said bathroom break.
And just don't assume that because we've had a case and it's over with, it may not come back again. So don't assume that. Remember, no chat rooms, no blogging, no Facebook, no Twitter, no emails, no talking to the individuals during breaks. Nothing to do about cases, okay? If you want to talk to staff or talk to members of other boards about it, that's fine. Just don't talk to each other about members, things that are going to come in front of you. It's real simple.
And Charlie, if I could say as well, that also includes utilizing third parties to pass along
right.
your perspective.
Don't use anybody as a go-between. Okay. That's real simple. Now, the other thing is public records law. It really isn't anything that you got to worry about, but everything you have is a public record. Real simple. Okay? Bob Hamilton always tells people not to bring the agendas home because if somebody comes to their house and wants a copy of the record, they have to have a copy machine and print it for them. I don't go that far. But everything is a public record. Quasi-judicial. Remember that everything you do is quasi-judicial and that you can't get information from other places. If you happen to run into somebody, a violator at the store, and starts telling you stuff about the case, you're not supposed to consider that in making your decision. The best thing to do is at that point disclose. I ran into Mr. Smith at Target. I told him I'm not going to discuss the case. He mentioned something to me. I'm disclosing it at this point. It's not going to affect me in my decision that I make today. Remember, you're quasi-judicial. You act as if you're judges. Conflicts of interest. If you are anything comes in front of you that you're going to make a economic benefit to you, that's going to benefit you, it's a conflict. Then you have a conflict of interest. You declare the conflict of interest. You can still discuss the matter. You just can't vote on the matter. Everybody with me? Conflict is very, very, the economic benefit is very narrow. Just because you happen to live, everybody can say, well, we're going to vote on an issue of that's something that goes on Speedway Boulevard. And if they fix that particular problem on Speedway Boulevard, it's going to affect everybody in town. That's too far-fetched. It has to be a specific interest to yourself that's going to bring you an economic benefit. Everybody with me so far? I had a situation where a city commissioner voted on a paving of the front of their house. They got an ethics violation. The ethics commissioner said, that's not a violation because it wasn't paving just in front of their house, it was paving the entire block. Everybody was benefiting, not just the commissioner. So that wasn't an ethics violation. So be real careful about it. If you have a question, bring it up. We'll try to help you with that. But the last thing I want to do is someone here in this room gets in trouble with the code of the Commission on Ethics because they've made an ethics violation. Yes, sir.
I know as board members we're supposed to be deaf, dumb, and blind to violations. I have one that I've fed up with. For 2 years I've looked at it. I have made a complaint.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, when it comes up, do I have to disclose that I'm one of the people that made the complaint?
You could if you want to, but it's, but you're not, you making the complaint is not going to be, is, you being in the area or making the complaint is not a conflict of interest. I would bring it up. I would say I'm a resident. I've given my information. This is, I don't think it's going to affect me. I'm going to make my decision based upon what's happening here in this room.
Yeah.
I had a. Yeah.
I did not make a written complaint. I made a verbal complaint to an officer.
But you're not bringing the case. They're bringing the case.
Right.
Okay. You could, you know. They're obvious. I mean, just don't do stupid things. I had a situation once where it was a code board case involving an adult entertainment facility in town, and one of the people on the code board was carrying placards with a sign protesting in front of the establishment that they were there. Well, you can't do that. You can't go, cannot go in front of the establishment protesting there and then decide to later on to make a decision on whether they violated the code or not. Can't do that. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Okay. Well, lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the statement of public interests. You want to put that up there, Amy? Unfortunately, we get these things. I don't like them, but just fill them out, do the best you can, send them back in, and you meet the requirements under the law. I think it's, especially for the, unfortunately, the statute says, appointed members of boards having the power to enforce local code provisions, and that's us. So why they put the code board in this here? They did. I don't think it should be here, but just send them on in. And
isn't that something new?
No. It's not new at all. It's been for years. It's been this way.
It's really easy. All you have to do is put a percentage of your assets.
You have to put for your numbers, yeah, not only dollar amounts. Right. Did they give you instructions when they sent it to you? I think that, doesn't the supervisor of elections send that out?
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, I got to fill one out too, so, and I know it's annoying, it's a pain in the neck, and you feel it's none of my, none of their business. Thank you for doing it, and just do it.
Make sure you keep a copy of the last one.
Right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it is.
No, because he was just appointed. So he'll get one next
year. He'll get one for next year, yeah.
It's coming. It's coming.
I know I spoke about these issues real quickly. Anybody have any questions about quasi-judicial public records, sunshine law, conflicts of interest, or the conflict? Anybody else have any questions? If it comes up, we'll be here to answer it. But I'm going to, I know I went through it real quick. I'm going to turn it back over to Tony now.
Okay. I just want one point before I go to the other divisions that I've asked to come and present to you guys. I had a question asked, and it was one of these early parts of what I wanted to mention. I think it's slide four, Amy. And that's, what's a quasi-judicial hearing, a quasi-judicial board? We've been using that term, and just so you know, I mean, Charlie pretty much said it, you know, before. What this note says, some confusion among the public as well, board members on what that role is as a quasi-judicial, but it just means that that there's gonna, it's, you're not a court, you're not a judge, but you're going to hear evidence. The evidence is going to be presented in a due process manner, so someone's going to have a right to be heard.
It's going to be sworn.
It's going to be sworn testimony. And based on that evidence or in testimony that you hear, you'll make decisions, and those decisions that you make will be based on whether or not the evidence is proven that there indeed a violation exists, as I said before. So as a quasi-judicial board, you have adversarial positions, you have different sides, and that's why it's important to recognize that you're not a rubber stamp of the city. There's two different sides presenting. You hear both sides. You understand what the rules are. If you have any doubt or question about the rule, turn to your attorney and make sure you understand it if there's something that you're trying to understand. But we'll present the rule, or you already have a book, or even when it's referenced, and then you make decisions based on what's been presented, only based on what's been presented. And because you're, and this is one of the big differences with a magistrate and a co-board, because you're bored, many times you'll want to deliberate or discuss and have an open discussion about if there's something of contention that you're trying to make determinations or decisions on. So you, if you got something you want to say to the rest of the members, you say it, because you don't get any other chance other than in this open meeting to discuss.
Just don't say the target.
Yeah. Say it again.
Don't say the target, though. Just say it at the open meeting.
Right, yeah. That's the only place you get to say, well, wait, I don't think, oh, maybe we should, and those types of things. So that's the point when you do that in that type of session. And then the points out, I thought it was a good point, that's why I put it here. The board's role is not to fashion a remedy for a violation, as we said before, or even suggest ways to come into compliance. The board merely determines if there's a violation. Ask reasonably what was the reasonable time to comply. Hear from both sides on what's being said. And one of the values, and we hadn't been able to have this broadness, and we had it in the past, if we can reach back, those who've been here a while, where we have multi disciplines on the board.
Right.
I mean, but the objective and idea the Code Board Act was to, you know, as much as we can, and it says that, as much as you can, have multiple disciplines so that you can rely on your own skills and knowledge as advisors one to another. Not that you individually make a decision based on what you know, but that you can say, well, one of the things I know about buildings is, and they said that, remember? So as you're trying to understand it, you can openly say that in your meeting as you're discussing it. Well, you know, and that's, you know, we've kind of brought that up a couple of times with you, but, you know, and as a real, I've been a real estate guy. I've been doing this. I've been over the years, and I know that it's not practical. You know, you can speak openly and make decisions. And then that last point, you know, that the your notice of compliance comes from the code inspector. I know a lot of times you get violators who, violators, respondents, who want to skip over, let's don't consider the inspector. I already know, well, if you already know, then the inspector needs to be coming in and confirming that with an affidavit. And so it's really the inspector that's going to raise that issue. Now, if there's a dispute and it's a legitimate dispute, y'all can hear those disputes and make decisions.
One of the most useful things that the code officers bring are the photographs.
That's been very
the most important.
And with that being said, there are and there will come occasions that, for example, if I'm on vacation, today's my first day back, I got 20 cases on the, I may not be able to run out before the case comes up and get new pictures. So the respondent comes in and says, I took this picture yesterday. I'm in compliance. Okay. Well, did you call the code inspector and set up an appointment for him to inspect it? Because they assume that we know when they're in compliance.
And it's not proper for you guys to go individually, go out and do your own private research on what's going on at the property.
Right.
Your eyes and your ears is extended to the code inspector. I need to know this. You know, we really need to know this. Okay, well, tell the code inspector to go find that out before you make a decision.
Good question when you specifically ask the code officer for his thing. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, just
to me.
Right. And that's the thing. Direct it to the code officer. He or she is the one that's dealing with that case.
Yeah.
They know the situations at hand.
And if you direct it to me, I'll point to the code officer if he's there.
I mean, there's occasions that, you know, it may be, for example, John Stenson. John Stenson covers from
You know, he has the whole, how can I put it to you, the whole northwest side of the city.
I guess we'll get to that at some point, but not right now.
Yeah, but I'm just giving that as an example. He's got a lot. So he may be on vacation, and he may ask Cliff Reckonzone to cover something for him. So Cliff may not have the answer because he hasn't worked the case. He's just filling in for John. Those are situations that...
And it depends on the circumstances. Because it's quasi-judicial hearing, he will have the answers necessary for a finding of compliance or non-compliance, or he'll have the answers necessary for you to make an imposition of a fine. Otherwise, he's going to hear from his attorney. So
no, and
that's just right, well understood.
What I'm saying is case details, in-depth details that sometimes...
Right, exactly.
He may not know. He's prepared for that case, for you all to make a decision, non-compliance, compliance, impose a fine, don't impose a fine.
Yeah, but as Hector said, the history and other case details he may not have been
right.
a part of because it wasn't his case.
And you may not feel that there, you may feel that there's not enough information. That you could ask for a continuance, say, come back next month with some additional information. You don't have to, you know, just because, as I said, we're not a rubber stamp for the city, and we're not going to always agree with them, but most of the times we will. But again, remember, you are a quasi-judicial board. You shouldn't be doing you're not private investigators. You shouldn't be going to the property and take a look and see what's going on. But if you happen to drive by it, so what? You know.
Exactly.
People drive by, but you can't not drive around town and see things.
You're a citizen.
You're a citizen.
This is time. Person is lying.
Huh. I would not go ahead and say that publicly. Or you'll get cut off by Ouija, but I'm just saying that's your I mean obviously we're asking, you know, if you think that the person's lying, you're not gonna vote for it. You're not gonna vote for it. You're gonna find them in violation.
And I mean the safest thing is just don't go there publicly. Yeah, I mean, there's euphemisms and ways to do it, but I don't advise it. Just leave it alone. Yeah.
Okay. Observations of that individual. Some may be drunk, some may be mentally ill, some may be high.
Yeah, and those are things that you have a right to consider. Just as Charlie said, when you start saying things publicly, you can find yourself possibly making wrong assumptions and then labeling someone in a way that may come back and be a problem in the future.
That's you or as a board member.
But individually, if that's your judgment, that's your judgment. Yes.
And once in a while, you'll have someone say, well, I applied for a permit 2 weeks ago. I still haven't heard anything.
Wonderful. Nice transition. This is what I was about to do.
We're going
to
cover that.
Appreciate it. I was about to say we should make a transition. So one of the things we wanted to do with this session is make sure that you had an opportunity to hear from other divisions that we have to call on to assist in bringing compliance or have issues that are broader, generally broader than what our code inspector may know, but it's still useful and beneficial to know that what divisions have this type of information and answer some questions that you may have on what they do in terms of assisting in the code enforcement process. What we have next on the agenda is for you to hear from Charles Bryan, and it's brief, on how the redevelopment department, what they're able to do to assist in compliance and those types of things and to aid the division. So we will call on Charles Bryan.
Thank you. I hope everyone can hear my kind of under weather. Got cold.
Take the mic if you want.
I think they can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Nah, take the mic.
I don't need the mic.
Yeah, it's very loud, so that'll probably get you.
Okay. Just want to give you a brief overview of what we do in redevelopment. And this is our statement. The redevelopment division is primarily responsible for the creation, implementation, and management of projects and programs in accordance with the policies and recommendations set forth in our community redevelopment plans that comprise five redevelopment districts. And those districts are Blue Row, Downtown, Main Street, Midtown, and South Atlantic. We also have three boards, which comprise of the Main Street, which has been changed to B Street redevelopment, and is combined with South Atlantic redevelopment area, Midtown, and Downtown and Blue Road has been combined as boards. So we have three boards that meet monthly. The Downtown Board meets on the first Tuesday of the month at noon. Midtown meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 o'clock. And B-Side meets the second Wednesday of the month at 6 o'clock. These boards are not like your board. They only are boards that have, they're in an advisory capacity. Our funds, what we do in redevelopment is governed by our community reinvestment agency, which is actually the city commission. So our funding and any project that go forward actually is approved by that governing authority. Any projects that come within the redevelopment area, we look at those projects and we make recommendations for approval. Unlike some of the other areas in the city, we have specific guidelines, design guidelines that we look at in redevelopment. An example would be we look at, and a lot of people flinch when I see this, is we look at the color of your house. You can only paint the house or business in the redevelopment area. It has to be approved by the redevelopment department. And the reason for that is that we want to make sure that those colors match what that guideline is for that particular area. And in order to help residents and also businesses, we have grants. We have different types of grants that can help either a residential property or a business property. Each one of those grants that we have, which we flip that from any. Yes. We have business facade grants, commercial facade grants, landscape improvement grants, leasehold improvement grants, lease subsidy grants, and residential facade grants. Each one of these grants, depending on what area you're in, redevelopment in, area you're in, is geared toward that particular redevelopment area.
Yes, sir. In terms of number six, residential facade, what percentage of your budget is actually spent on residential facade?
I don't know I can't give you a specific percentage. I know that I have $50,000 available for grants for my particular area, which is Midtown. Okay, and the reason mine is geared specifically for Midtown because we have a lot of residentials, in Midtown versus downtown. You got a lot of commercial buildings downtown, so. Downtown grants are geared toward commercial bases, where Midtown is geared toward residential. For an example, in Midtown, I can assist a residence with air conditioned roofs, fences in the front yard, things of that nature, where downtown is geared toward like restaurants, bringing those type of businesses into the area. So that's why each grant is geared towards specifically that particular redevelopment area.
I'm sorry, so I can say, members of the board, you may be about to ask this, one of the reasons that it's important for y'all to know what he's saying here is that there are times when you will have people come before you and they're saying that's their delay. They're trying to get these funds. They have a plan or they're trying to find out about a plan, or sometimes staff may say, well, we know this is available, so we want them to connect with redevelopment, they're in a redevelopment area, and this is available to them. So that's kind of something to be aware of.
And also, when you look at redevelopment grants, our grants are matching grants up to $5,000 in most cases, but it's reimbursement process. You have to go through an application process, The best thing about it is that there's no income qualifiers. Like in, if you go through community development, you got to meet a specific income guideline. With redevelopment, if you are in that area, automatically you qualify for that grant. There's no repayment of it, but it is a redevelopment process, and it's an application process. You actually have to complete the application. We go out, we take before pictures. You present the application to us, we review it, and we send a letter authorizing that you've been approved. Once you get necessary permits through permission and license, the work has been done. We go out again, we take pictures to make sure the work has been done. They supply us with receipts showing that it's actually been paid in full. We go so far as to say you got to present us with a check that's actually run through the bank, the front and back side of the check, showing it's actually been paid to the contract, because we've had instances where we've got a receipt from the contractor saying it's been paid, and they're calling us, asking us when we're going to pay the customer. And we're saying, you're supposed to be paid already, so we make sure that we get that check, the front and back side, showing us clear the bank, and within 10 business days, we will make sure that they get a check for the amount that's been approved. Yes, ma'am.
Two super quick questions. One, does the work have to be done by a contractor? And number two, do you have to get two quotes from a contractor?
Yes, both. The work has to be done by a licensed contractor. You do have to have at least two quotes from licensed contractors. And all this is on the website. That's why I'm not really going through it. If you go to the city's website for the redevelopment, click on grants. It has all the different grants that you saw here, but all the criteria and also the application. You can get an application online.
But I didn't see those two things on that list anywhere. I'm sorry.
Which?
The two things, you know, that it has to be done by a contractor and that you need two quotes.
It might not be right there, but it's enough. And when you contact us, we'll make sure that you're aware that you need at least the two quotes. We take the lowest quote that you have. Doesn't mean you have to go with that one, but when we look at reimbursement, we're only going to pay on the smaller.
But I can't do the work myself.
You cannot do the work yourself. No. Because we want to make sure it's done right, and in most cases it's got to be inspected by.
Well, it would be inspected by an inspector anyway. If it was permitted and done by me, and somebody came and checked it out and said it's beautiful, because I build a better fence than anybody in the neighborhood.
That's true enough. We believe you, but you have to realize.
I think that's the reimbursement criteria.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You can do it yourself if it's not, if there's no permit permitting requirement,
right.
But for reimbursement purposes,
yeah,
you're going
to
have to follow the
criteria. The criteria for our program, it has to be done by a licensed contractor. Yes.
I don't want to get too far afield, but you said $50,000 for all the grants you give out?
That's just for my time.
Just for Midtown, but
yeah.
for the residential, commercial?
No, for the residential.
Or was that just for the residential?
No, that's for all the grants.
That's all I have for Midtown.
And the reason for that is because we get funded through tax increment dollars.
Right.
It's based upon the values of properties in the area, and Midtown value is not as high as some of the other redevelopment areas.
So sometimes when you come before us and we say, is there anything you can do, there's nothing you can do because the funds have been used up.
And that's when I try to refer them to, community development.
Right.
We have more funds.
Right.
But the process is a lot longer. And like I said, they have to meet the income qualifications in order to get there.
I'm not sure how to phrase this. We have cases which people come up and they say they're trying to fix the property. Then they are caught between catch-22 with the permits, catch-22 with you guys about trying. The CRA has only one purpose, issue permits. That's the purpose of the CRA, is to improve the community. So you want as many permits out there as you can. You want people doing things. There seems to be a feeling, and I'm not attacking your department, it may
maybe I am, that when you deal with the CRA, the automatic assumption is it's supposed to slow everything down, which to me is just the opposite.
We have nothing to do with the permit process. That's this bill right here.
Well,
we're going to talk about
that. The CRA brings in this whole, there's a whole list, what you can build, what you can't build, historical value. It's all intertwined with you and permits. Both, they can't really be separated. There's a property on B Street, for instance, where they've been fixing the windows or changing the front of it for 2 years. And the claim is it's the CRA that's causing the problem. That may not be true, but that's the claim. And are we going to ever address these things?
Well, we do have design guidelines. If they don't meet the design guidelines, we don't approve.
Well, I'm just saying, if somebody comes into this system, from my point of view, we're supposed to be guided as quickly as possible. And people keep saying, people have different ideas of what they hear. Keep saying, well, they told me. The same with the permits. Is there some way that can be documented so that we don't become a referee constantly?
Well, we work with permits and licenses all the time. Like I said, any application that comes in and then the redevelopment area is automatically sent up to the redevelopment project manager for that area to review and work with the reviewer down the permits and licenses. But like I said, we do have the land development code and we do have design guidelines that we have to go by. And if they don't meet them, then we can't approve them.
I think what you're referring to is again, it's human nature. You can't go based on everything that they say. Number two is that they'll wait until the upkeep hour to then turn around and say, I applied, I haven't heard. Now, that's why we now take snapshots of when they apply for the permit, and we pull it up and we show it on the screen. Because again, if Donald Smart waited till June 29th, which is today, and he would, and he's supposed to come into compliance July 5th, you know what? That's not our problem.
That is correct.
The city, meaning, he applied. He's going to you as
ultimately.
Correct.
On what you do about it.
It's your decision now. Take that into consideration. Well, he waited until the upkeep hour. City's not at fault. City's made recommendations. He needed to bring in different blueprints or revise this or revise that. He waited till, again, the umpteenth hour to bring it in. So these are things that, again, maybe you as a board aren't privy to because, again, if we did that with every single case, we'd be there until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're trying to give you the base, the meat and potatoes when we're presenting our facts.
But when you assume that when someone's under oath, I mean, you kind of have to assume they're telling you the truth unless you're presented evidence to the contrary.
Right. And that's when we come up and say, this is what happened,
Right.
Charles is there for
right.
us. The benefit of having Charles
but
there.
Having those dates would be really helpful in making that decision.
Each redevelopment area has their own funds.
So
that's why I say for Midtown, I only have $50,000 for grants and Midtown. But another answer to your question is that we, as project managers, we have access to the Tricket system. So I could go in the Tricket system and look at code cases. I can go in whenever a permit is filed, it goes into the tracking system. It's automatically, we get an email saying you got a permit to look at, and track it, here's the permit that you need to look at, and you approve it right online. So we look at that every day to make sure, so we don't slow down the process.
And those of you who have been around for a while, you know that these processes are processes that weren't always available to us, and they keep getting better and better each year, and we're constantly improving them so that they are, you know, real-time information that can assist us to be able to tell you exactly what you need to know.
Really important.
Right, they
are. Yeah, and in most cases, we interact with, like you said, John Spencer has a certain area. My court officer is Officer Sykes. So we communicate and we talk all the time about different things that are going on in that particular, in the Midtown area. And so we interact pretty much with all the departments of the city from a redevelopment standpoint. Yes, ma'am.
I'm in the redevelopment area. Okay. And when I first came to town, I wrote a grant or got a grant for some improvements to our building. And it was matching fund of $5,000. I haven't heard a number on how much money is available in that district. You did mention it.
What?
In the redevelopment area.
Which
Main Street?
Beachside. Okay. I don't know what the amount is available for Beachside right now, but normally if you receive a grant, I think it was the last 2 or 3 years, I can find out specifically for you that you're not eligible until after that time frame elapsed.
This was several years ago when I first came to town. I was a grant writer in my last life, and I'm really interested in getting as many as we can. Like for landscape improvements, can it be redevelopment of the landscape? Can that work? And do you have any grants that are not matching funds?
No, we don't. All exception would be Midtown. We have grants that are not matching in Midtown, but what happens is it's 100% grant, but we put a lien on the property.
Okay.
And
it's free.
And how long is that lien on?
Lien is for 30 years.
It's 30 years?
Yes. But it's 100% grant. It's for to help residents who can't afford, if they need a roof or they need air condition or whatever. We've done one that I know of that we actually helped the lady do a roof and some painting on the outside of the building, and she agreed to do the lien on the property. Yeah. That's the only one I know of. But I know we got another presenter, so if you have any more questions, if you need a copy of my PowerPoint, Amy has it. She can email it to you. You could go online, like I say, and look up
Charles Redevelopment Worksheet.
And you can find all the information that I just talked to you. If you need to talk, call me. My number is 386-671-8185.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
I would like to just say, really, it gives me a lot of solace of complete that Charles is usually in all our meetings.
Yes, absolutely.
And he's there to step in when that dialogue be like stranded and don't know where to go.
Right.
And to me, I really appreciate that, Charles, and I think all
of us
Thank you very much, Charles. Next, we have our agenda said we had someone from the planning division. Unfortunately, they had something come up where they weren't able to be here for us today. They contacted us and informed us that they were sick, so they apologize. But, yes. So, next we'll hear from Permits and Licensing Division and on.
Glenn Urquhart.
Good afternoon. My name's Glenn Urquhart. I'm the deputy code official with the City of Daytona Beach. I'm standing for my boss because he's doing a radio show. So I had a couple things going. Just want to kind of give you a roundabout of our division, our mission and our vision statements. Our mission to safeguard the public, promote the health, safety, and the welfare of the city of Daytona Beach through administration and enforcement of state and city regulations governing the structures and the occupations. Our vision to achieve a more streamlined, efficient, and defined system in which day-to-day processes will meet or exceed the public's expectations. Also, to develop a process to help facilitate an enjoyable building experience. The permits and license divisions are our units. We have the permits side of it, which is building, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, fire protection, new construction, remodeling, and improvements, compliance with state building and fire codes. And then we have the licensing division, which is inclusive of business occupations, vehicles for hire, taxi cabs, special events, and dog tags. So we've got a lot of stuff coming through the division. Divisional goals, continually evaluate our processes and the procedures for the ways of doing business. Increase the efficiency through the use of technology and the education. Invest in our people through additional training, licensures, and certifications. And work with other departments to meet a common goal while achieving customer satisfaction. Our past year achievements, hire an additional technical staff to meet growing demands with the new construction activity in the growing economy. Reorganization of staff with emphasis on cross-training and increasing customer service standards. And providing a qualified building and fire inspectors on all commercial and residential projects. And a unified concept of being first preventers. We can present a finished product through in-depth inspections that will reflect code safety and a safe environment for the citizens. Some enhancements in our department include increasing the staffing of the public service counter, constructing a new public service counter that better serves the needs of our customers, instituted the use of iPads for field inspectors, and this helps real-time inspections, so while they're out there, they can go ahead and attach pictures or the inspections as they're happening so the contractors don't have to wait for the results. And also the interaction between departments to open up lines of communication to help speed up the permitting review process, which ultimately results in customer satisfaction. And this is always an ongoing process. It's never always the perfect model. And I'm sure from y'all driving around and everything, as far as the current construction projects that are going on, I'm just going to give you a little roundabout, but we have, you know, over 50 main commercial projects just in itself. But One Daytona, that's an $800 million project. It's inclusive of Bass Pro Shops, Cobb Theater, hotels and apartments. Got the Hard Rock Hotel eventually going to get going. Tanger Outlet Stores with 85 proposed tenants. That's for the November 18th opening, right around the corner. Integra Sand Apartments up on Williamson. Daytona Hotel and Convention Center in the parking garage over on Seabreeze. We have 4,400 new homes coming over the next 15 years with the Mentos and the Bayberry subdivisions. Multiple hotel renovations going up all the way up down A1A, and this is all for structural upgrades. We just completed the second phase of Shady Place development. That's eight buildings, three stories high. And four new dorms at Bethune-Cookman University. We just finished the last two today. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, they got a 188-room facility for students underway right now. Student Union Building, it's a $75 million project that's just breaking ground. Their research center and their wind tunnel, all of this on Clyde Morris. So a lot of movement over in that area. And, of course, the Tomoka Town Center out there by Tanger, which is going to be bringing hotels, retail, and apartments. I'm sure you've got questions.
Yeah. My understanding is that without any input from this board, I guess I don't know why you'd want any input from this board, but we're going to shift code enforcement under permits and licensing. Is that being discussed? And how is that going to improve our product or help us?
It's actually going to streamline the process, because what happens when you have different departments or divisions, this will happen over here, and these people over here aren't cognizant of what's going on in that division. By streamlining the process of having code enforcement and with permits and licensing, they start the code case, and then they present it to us, and then we interact with them, as far as going out to the actual location. Then you got to follow it through the legal process. So you have to do the background check on all the liens and everything that's attached to that property and all the people that are involved. So to the regular person, it appears that it's a long process, but we don't want to leave anybody out of the process because they might be an owner of the property, and then if they show up and the whole thing's demolished, and they're like, where's my property? I was never notified. So we have to go through the lengthy behind-the-scenes process of making sure everyone's notified before we can get into demolition of properties and stuff like that. But interacting directly with code enforcement, when they come over to permits and licenses, which will be happening this year, we will then be able to interact firsthand, and it's going to be a better product for the community because then we can solve the problems together. Because I might not know what's going on in Hector's workload. He doesn't know what's going on over in our workload. But when we can get the lines of communication built up, we can better streamline the process to go ahead and get the problem solved, because that's the number one thing for you guys, is to make sure that the problems are solved, the code cases are closed. But sometimes if the communication lines aren't open, this person doesn't know what the other person's doing. So I think it's a really good move, and it's going to work out. And at the same time, I was talking a little while ago with both Hector and Tony about putting the process together with all the departments inclusive, where you have code enforcement, you have permits and licensing, you have Charles with redevelopment on what different property locations in his area that need to be addressed and stuff. But once again, even though there's, like, if you get into the demolition side of it, even though people want certain things demolished, there has to be money in the budget to do that. And also to be able to, we have to find the people that we have to interact for the demos. So it is a process, and I know it seems like a long process for everybody outside the barriers, but we are working towards a common goal to make it a better process.
Is there going to have a director who sees if this process works, or is this piece of paper going to start?
No.
And then you hope that it gets back.
This gentleman that's sitting here,
he's
calmly smiling, this is our deputy city manager,
yes.
Gary, I don't want to shimmy, okay, so he oversees the permitting and licensing division, and Michael Garrett and me and everybody else underneath him, so we will be accountable to him.
Let me ask you a question. Very often there's a lot of confusion, not necessarily confusion, but there's a very fine line between code work and police work. Whether the problem is, I mean, sometimes they, in code cases, right, it overlaps. Whether, not that you're doing police work, but that when you get a code case, there's often illegal activity going on. Are you getting what I'm saying?
Correct.
The question is, will those people, will police still be part of the process in looking at that? That's my question. Okay.
As far as the change that's coming about, it's just me reporting to another individual. The day-to-day operations is going, everything that's going on today will remain the same. The only thing is that I will be at City Hall. My staff will be, just like now, at a different location. The public will have more accessibility to me. Instead of coming here to the police department, they'll be able to see me at City Hall. But the day-to-day operations is staying the same. There's going to be no difference whatsoever. Now, the fact that now, presently, today, we are under the police department, the communication and the relationship is not going to be strained in any way. I will still have accessibility to Chief Chitwood and everything else. However, what people need to realize is that the Chief of Police is exactly what his title is, the Chief of Police. He is not the Chief of Code Enforcement. So people run to him assuming that he's going to snap a finger and something's going to happen. The process does not change. The process still remains that we are legally bound by Florida State Statute 162, and we have to follow those guidelines.
Right.
So the change of neighborhood services, because everybody keeps referring to code enforcement, it's neighborhood services. Neighborhood services entails code enforcement. It entails animal control. It entails the rental program. So there's a variation of everything is going under the permitting department. However, it's still staying the same.
Are you funding the rental program?
The rental program funds itself. The rental program funds itself working through its inspections and everything else. I'm sorry?
Is it working with this giant funding?
Are we a little bit outside of the scope of
workshop?
I'll leave the question for an answer later.
Yeah.
But to interject, as far as like what Ed was saying, is a lot of times people think building inspectors, code inspectors, we're all lumped into the same thing. And they have different jurisdictions than we do. We have jurisdiction once an active permit is opened up.
Right.
Then we can go onto the property. But before then, it's a jurisdiction of the code inspectors. Those are the guys that go out and they start the case. We can come in and assist and give interpretations once they call us and stuff. But they start the case. That's their area of expertise. You know, they're the code inspectors. Building inspectors, electrical, mechanical, plumbing, all, that is for actual permits that are pulled, new construction and remodels and all stuff like that.
Who's the Board of Adjustments? The Board of Adjustments, is that going to be under you?
The variance board.
Yeah.
This part of the planning board.
That's part of the planning board.
I'm in this general development. I don't know what they're called anymore. Development
of the city. Has something to do with code. Could you go there to violate code? Who goes there to violate? When you take something to the Board of Adjustments,
we don't take anything to the Board of Adjustments.
Let me help. So, Neil, you're right in the sense that a variance board is just that. It's a board that's asking for an opportunity because of some hardship to be able to do something that's outside what's been the limits, what's been established in the code.
Right.
And so in that regard, yeah, sometimes we have people who come before the code board, and again, this is for the board, that come before the code board, and they want to be allowed to do something that we've already determined is a violation of the code, but they'd like to be able to do it, and we may have a provision in our code that would allow them to seek a variance. Sometimes there's certain provisions in our code where variance isn't allowed, but many times, unfortunately, sometimes we know that at the front end and we nip it in the bud. But if we don't, then we'll go and make those determinations, come back at the next meeting, and if they're able to go before variance, it's been the routine and probably quite reasonable, and I think Charlie would agree, to allow someone, if there's a provision that allows them to seek alternative remedy, but I'm going to seek that alternative remedy. And so that's typically the position of staff is if that provision is allowed and they're actually making the application, that they'd be allowed enough time and opportunity to make that application. Yes?
So I'll just ask you, as the zone officer who's the liaison for the Board of Adjustment.
So you just heard that. Rose asked you what
she's associated with that application.
Yeah. So the zoning officer, y'all we've had Rose come before the board before on a number of various issues related specifically to zoning, but even the knowledge of what's coming up with the Board of Adjustment. That's about the number.
For the record, Tony, was there any question for? Did you hear a permitting question earlier?
No.
Thank you.
Okay, if that's everything for permits, we're kind of a little bit over time, but I wanted to just take a quick touch on just a couple other areas, and I'll do it as a quick touch again for my effort to try and satisfy the objective of making sure you guys have heard and know some things that you may not have had to consider up to this point. Some of the things that the statute provides that we hadn't talked about that you may be wondering about or you may not have had to consider, and they're not issues of major, but they're just things to know. The reason we have Amy doing everything for you guys is because the statute provides that staff will provide, the local governing body will provide the clerical staff. So that she's the clerical staff being provided by the city to handle the matters that come before this board. And that's why she contacts you, that's why you all get the stuff from her, and that she's the appropriate person to make contact with as part of one of the functions, that she, one of the many functions, but part of the the functions that she have. Know also that there are various powers that the statute gives a code enforcement board to adopt rules, which we've done. When we have a situation, we don't have it very much, but sometimes may need to subpoena someone for a hearing. I think we've done it once, maybe.
We've done it very often.
Yes, it's not something that comes up. You have the power to subpoena evidence. You never really have to do that. You just tell us to get the evidence, we get it to you. But that's a power to the board. Obviously, you take testimony under oath and then issue orders in the court with the force of law. And that's what makes sure that the orders that we can follow through with. With the fine situation, y'all understand the process. Y'all have seen the process. The process is as Hector did when he went through the anatomy of how a court case comes, goes through the process. At the end of that process, if a person is found in violation of the code, and the board typically will be asking for a fine to be imposed. There is criteria for you to consider in determining the amount of the fine. I'll tell you that the staff tries to be consistent with what they ask for, but there's criteria that you should be considering based on what's in our code and what's in the state law. Because our city is greater than 5,000
right.
in population, we were able to adopt an enhanced fine program. So our program is a little more than some other smaller jurisdictions. The standard jurisdictional fine numbers are $250 per day for a fine of, I think it's $1,000 for a repeat violation, and then
it's $50,000.
I'm sorry? No, on a repeat violation.
Okay.
On a standard fine, $1,000, $5,000, and $250 and $500. Right.
We can jump up because of the fact that we're a bigger city.
Right, because we're a bigger city. Right, it's $250 then $500 and then the $5,000. But because we're a bigger city, we're $1,000 for the standard fine maximum is $1,000. The repeat violation fine maximum is $5,000. And then if we have the
incremental.
Irreparable. Irreparable.
You want to talk about that? I don't think we've ever had that, have we? Irreparable?
No.
Well, we make arguments that you have it.
An irreparable violation would be, for example, if I cite a property owner, a residential property owner, for removing a tree without a permit.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, he took the tree down.
Right.
So he's got to go down and file for a permit, but it's irreparable. He can't put that tree back.
Right.
So that's an irreparable violation. That's an example of one.
Yeah, that's an example. And we have other remedial rules that solves the tree problem, but that is a true definition of a good way to look at what the irreparable and the reversible. Something that once it's gone, it's gone. You can't undo it. Okay? But in terms of the fines, I was about to tell you that you do have criteria you're supposed to look at. You're supposed to be looking at the gravity of the violation. Look at information and everything else. How significant, how great is this violation? Our objective, especially when we're talking about fines that are significant, I tend to try real hard to give you that information through the testimony. That's something that we ought to be doing, especially if it's contested. The actions taken to correct the violation, you should be considering. What did the respondent do when they were told about the violation? What did they do once you gave the order for them to comply? How much good faith effort has been made to try and comply with the violation. That's a consideration that you make. And then previous violations committed. What's the history of violations on this response? And the thing is, understand, and it's fine, I don't have a problem with it. In fact, I think it's wonderful that, we make recommendations, and that tends to guide you on the consistency of what the board desires. But ultimately, the fine is within the hands and the power of the board. And if you think we're too light and you want to be harsher, then you can be. If you think we're too harsh and you want to be light, then you can be. And that's 100% in your purview and outside. We'll make our argument. We'll take a position. We'll make recommendation. I'll express even while we think it's consistent and reasonable. But ultimately, it's the positions to be
made by you as a board. Something you may want to know that you may not realize, that the liens that we impose, they are general liens. What you have, and from a lien perspective, you have general liens and specific liens. General specific liens apply to a specific property, and that's the only place it applies. General liens, when they apply to real property, they apply to all property owned by the responder. So when we impose a lien against House 35B Main Street, then that goes to everything else that property owner owns, that attaches. And that's called an encumbrance. So when someone does a public,
title search,
it shows up, and that would affect, it's a cloud on the title is what it's called, and it's a cloud on the title, and they have to remedy it generally before they're able to get loans or do anything else with the property.
I'm not sure I understand that. When you say it's against all of their properties,
all their real property.
You have one board, you're signing for one?
Yep.
It's against all of
them? All of them.
All of them, yep. Well, I mean, we can go beyond that, but it's recorded in the county.
In the county.
Yeah. So it's pretty much, in effect, really in the county. I mean, can we go after someone in vain with the tax lien if we do it? There's a way, but... There's a way.
Yes.
Yeah, everything is encumbered. So when he tries to borrow some money on that property, the title company is going to say, wait a second, you got to take care of this lien that they have over here in Daytona. When he tries to sell it, the buyers, if they did a proper title search, say, wait a second, you got to take care because they're not going to get title insurance. You know, so this, and that's one of the reasons why we deal so often with people with remedying lien reviews, and that's why they come in. Many times desperate when it's last notice, or at least from their perspective. Reality is, they have been sitting there for the last 7 years, they never looked for it, but now that they see it, it's an emergency because they can't
see it
until
it's
done.
But aren't
all of commercial property as well?
Yeah, that's both
commercial and residential, and I'll give you an example. Altamont Springs, I had a property owner there, a commercial property owner. His fine actually was like $250,000. He was trying to sell a commercial piece of property in Melbourne, and I distinctly remember this because I got the phone call and they said, how can we work this out? They were fine. We can work it out.
Yeah,
so he ended up going before a lien review, and out of the $250, I think they gave him half, so he ended up paying $125,000. That had to be paid before he could sell that property down in Melbourne. So that's commercial and residential as well.
Now, let me ask you a question. If that person also has a mortgage on that property.
Mortgage takes precedence over the lien.
It has a mortgage, and it also has a lien, a secondary lien, or whatever we're calling it. If that person goes to buy another property, then the mortgage doesn't matter. We're only talking about the cloud on the title.
Right.
We're not talking about the mortgage.
Nothing to do with the mortgage.
Nothing to do with the mortgage.
I think the foreclosure out.
Yeah.
If a mortgage is foreclosed, and it happens to our lien?
Yes.
Yeah, our lien goes to the, when that goes, typically, our lien goes as well.
Right.
Recent case law, first in town, first in right. I mean, it was something we debated and discussed for a long time, whether you could or which one was priority.
Right.
And recent case law came out and said, you know what, what's priority is what's recorded first. If that mortgage is in there, mortgage wins, sorry, Charlie, or sorry, Tony, or whoever else.
It doesn't matter, though, if they miss us or if we're recorded first. So there are circumstances where it's still good, and it's still good against other properties, just
Different jurisdictions have different practices. Our practice is that even though someone's perspective is that, okay, your lien's no good, it doesn't change the fact that it's still good against, it's no good against that property under certain circumstances, but it may be good against other properties they own.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't just start erasing liens just because someone says, it's bad against this property. Okay, fine. It's bad against this one. You agree it's good against this one. So your title search still says you got a problem, right?
Right.
So we got to get
it. If they still own the property, then we make them go fix it.
Yeah, that's one other property.
For their other property they're trying to sell.
And again, this is for the new members of the board.
It's an administrative thing.
Right. The whole issue of lien review is really for us, typically. And I think we had a little something different came up recently, but typically it's someone who's gone out and remedied the situation that had occurred previously that was the result of a lien. Now, they may still have an ugly piece of property, we don't, but our criteria is that whatever was the nature of your violation that caused you to have a lien, that's been taken care of before we'll ever have a conversation with you about.
That one was allowing a short sale to continue so the new owner buying the property at short sale could repair it.
And what Amy's really saying is, what's in the best interest of the city to go ahead and do it, and so the city made recommendations and supported a remedy.
Now, you can't take it upon yourself as a code enforcement officer if a slumlord has one piece of property that's really bad to look at other pieces that they own?
No.
You just have to go by individual complaint?
No. But what can happen is if Charlie and Tony can join in on this, is I own property A, and it was found in non-compliance for outside storage or gone maintenance, dilapidated roof, whatever. Now, property B in the same city, I don't have to go through the first step of the notice of violation. I can do the notice of hearing and be considered that could be considered as a repeat violation, although it's not on the same property.
Yeah, the definition.
Well, it's the same violation.
When I skipped repeat, the definitions, that was one of the key important definitions that's worth noting, is that one of the things that you deal with sometimes, or which will come your way, are repeat violators. Mm-hmm. It requires us to get a notice that we're going to take them before you as a repeat violator. Repeat violator is someone who has committed the same violation of the same code of ordinance on. And it's been found in non-compliance, by whether it's been by a court, by our board, by another board somewhere else, and it happened within the last 5 years. If it happened within the last 5 years, they've been previously found in non-compliance for the same issue, then we can bring them before you as a repeat violator. What does that mean? It means that the first thing that's different pursuant to statute is that we don't have to wait 30 days to give them that time to comply, because they've already had that knowledge of this issue as a violation in the past, and so it's presumed knowledge that they would be that carries over. So what we do is we bring them immediately to the board, and we ask for, one, we get to bring them immediately to the board. We don't have to have the board wait for them to violate the board's order, which is really what happens typically. Our typical requirement is, and this is requirement by law, was that Massey? But it's requirement by law that says that the first thing that has to happen is there must be a finding of noncompliance, and then the board has to give them an order requiring compliance. They have to violate the order of the board before they can be sanctioned. That's the standard process. When it's repeat violation, the process changes. They can be sanctioned based upon the fact that they committed that violation. When you come to the, we notify the code board, they go before the code board or magistrate, they go before for a hearing, and based upon the findings in that hearing, they can be a fine can be imposed at that initial proceeding.
Wow, you can wipe out a bunch of
some words with that.
It may seem easy,
but it's not. There's a lot of dotting of the I's and crossing of the T's to make sure that
falls into play. So if they own multiple properties and they committed one violation on one property,
it affects all the properties.
It affects all the properties. But I think, and just clarification, and I think this is the cringe or discomfort, because someone has one bad property, we can't go out and presume or operate with an assumption that all the properties make that property.
Doesn't give me the right to
we still have to operate on our
just because he's not found in violation.
Right. Yes.
One of the things that we had some confusion about, at least in my mind, when we find we have a hearing, we determine compliance, non-compliance, that's cut off to impose a fine. When it comes up for the fine, and they come into compliance, shouldn't we? I thought we agreed that the ruling normally would be non-compliance, now in
compliance, we do that.
Will find.
Yeah, you
know, we do that.
Well, and I know, I understand. Anyone who's historic will say that. You've been here a while. Anyone who's been here a while should say that. I would say that because historically, we called them by choice will fines.
Right.
We said we give people will fines, but that was really just a pet name.
Repeat violation.
It's really
it would be
right. Once there's a finding of noncompliance, then that triggers by law that the next time they violate it, it's going to be a repeat violation.
Right.
So it's already triggered once we've made the finding of noncompliance.
Before it got to the enforcement.
Before we got to the enforcement process.
Then how many years?
5 years. So I think that's everything that I really wanted to make sure I covered. I don't know if anyone else have anything else. I know we went a little bit over the time. I think we covered some good stuff. Obviously, you're always open to individually. Well, I prefer you individually call me, and I'll see if it's something you should be talking to the attorney. You get to call Charlie. That's kind of weird.
They don't call very often.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, but we try and avoid, you know, building up a properly so an attorney.
They don't call very often. And, very rare. It's very rare.
But if, you know, if you have some, I think the best place to go first, if you have something you're trying to figure out or understand, is Amy. She's just a tremendous, very busy, but a tremendous resource. And quite honestly, if it's something that trips her up, she'll come see me. But she usually knows things that I don't know, or she remembers things that I forgot, or something like that. But whatever it is, I have to go to Amy many times and say, Amy, what are we doing with something like that? So she's a good resource. Now,
I know you all want to get out of here, and I've tried to accommodate as quickly as possible, but since you didn't get the planning version,
good, thank you.
I can talk a little bit about that if you want me to, but what I really want to talk to you about is property rights. When somebody comes in and says, that's my property, you can't tell me what to do with it. Have you ever heard that before?
Yes.
Have
many
you ever
times.
Said it yourself? First thing I have to ask you is, where do property rights come from in the first place? Does anybody have any idea? Yeah, most people never think about that. Where did your property rights in the United States come from?
It came from the state, and prior to that, the King of England.
That's partially correct. It came from a sovereign. It could either be Britain, France, Spain, or Russia, depending on where you live. And when the sovereign gave you a grant on property, he gave you a bundle of rights, which is things you can do on your property, and a bundle of responsibilities. There are four things that the sovereign kept when granting those properties. He kept a right to tax you. He kept the right to police power. And that's a broader sense than a police officer showing up in your court. What we're talking about in police power extends to things like planning and zoning and other things that you can do on your property. So that's where this stuff comes from. A couple other things that he kept was eminent domain. You've all heard that argument. The government, upon paying you the true value of your property, can take it from you. And they also kept what's called escheat, which the attorneys will tell you what that is. If you die without any living heirs, then the property goes back to the government. So this is how we got around to having you guys sitting around a board telling people what they can do on their property. So next time you hear somebody say, it's my property, you can't tell me what to do on it, you know what the answer is. Government has retained police power. And that police power is very broad. Was it Ambler versus Euclid around the turn of the 20th century that indicated that planning
is older than me.
Zoning. I'm relying on the
attorney. Time.
That said that zoning was in effect and illegal. Expression of the police power by the state.
Yeah.
So that's where we can tell you how the bulk of the building you put on your property, what it sits next to, and of course that came down from court cases, for example, like you have a nice residential area and somebody brought in a slaughterhouse next door. That's why you have zoning. So those are the kind of issues that, again, you deal with, but I think it's really important that you know where they came from and know that government actually does have that legal function because they kept it when they gave you the property.
What you're really saying is law is what the judge says it is.
No, not really.
They've got two probing cases, and that everything is decided by case law. And they can,
but case law has to be dependent upon the U.S. Constitution or on the state level on the state constitution.
So they reverse it, like the Dred Scott
well,
case.
You can make some certain arguments about that. Yeah. That's very true. Any questions about the planning and zoning portion of this? Okay, I know you want to get out of here. I just want to get out.
Thank you.
They probably did have some there, but I'm bending
right
around. All right. Well, thank you for the citizens who came out, and thank you, board, for your attention, and thank you, staff members who came and assisted. And this will conclude our meeting. Thank you so much.
Got a lot of stuff covered. Got a lot of stuff covered. Good job, Tony.
Thanks,
sir. We got through a lot of stuff today.
Yeah, we went through a lot, huh? For a little bit of time. I was saying, well, we need 4 hours. We need 6 hours. We almost did.
I was thinking, though, sometime we could do this and maybe open it up to other people in the community. I mean, they'll come.
Yeah, sure we've done that before.
Yeah.
What we hadn't done is direct to the board in a while.
Because we really don't have, like, you know, there's really nothing in Volusia County that does all this stuff.